Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to start the program by revisiting an old friend on their anniversary. I can't believe that it's been that many years since we first talked to Sherelle Klaus from Dry Soda.
Well, she's been in business 10 years, but we only talked to her like about 7 or 8 years ago.
Right, but that was sort of at the beginning. But and they are having a 10th anniversary.
It's the same wonderful story, an ingenious idea that really caught on, and living proof that nice guys or nice girls, for that matter, finish first.
Well, it's been a long time. We first talked to Sherelle Klaus in 2008. Well, you've come a long way, Sherelle. That was about when you started, right?
Yeah, it was just about a year or two after we started, and it's been an amazing journey, and we've definitely found our groove and found some great success in the last 10 years, and it's really because of just the amazing supporters and consumers that we have out there that really understood what we were trying to do with Dry and have grasped onto it.
Yeah, it's Dry Soda we're talking about, and you were right on it early on this whole trend away from these sugary beverages. And also, I mean, I have to recall the story you told about what led you to develop this was you didn't have anything to drink when you were pregnant, and you wanted something that was sophisticated enough and that you wouldn't feel silly and you wouldn't feel deprived. And I asked you just now, how old is that baby that you were pregnant with?
Yep, and he is my little guy who's going off to junior high. He's going to sixth grade, so he's had a life full of Dry Soda, that's for sure.
Now there is a particular numerical reason why we're talking to you right now, because the magic number is 10, right?
That's right. We are 10 years old this summer.
Did you ever think you'd get anywhere close to that?
You know, that's funny that I was thinking about that in the middle of the night last night, knowing I had this interview today and thinking there's a bunch of stuff around that 10-year anniversary I'm thinking about. And I think I thought that, yes, I thought we would get here. I just didn't know exactly where we would be. But, yes, I thought, you know, I would eventually get here to this 10-year mark. And it was just, I just didn't know exactly which path, you know, if it would be a straight path or it would be kind of a curvy path or what. So, yep. But it's very exciting to be here and to be thinking back on these last 10 years and each step in this journey.
Now, somebody in the soda business just was trumpeting the fact that they were stopping using aspartame, is it?
Oh, yeah.
And they were going to use something else instead. Do you recall who that was? And then tell us how Dry is different for those listeners who are used to Diet Coke because they don't know any better.
Right. Well, you know, the idea behind Dry really was about bringing really great flavors to soda. And in my mind at the time, if I wanted to pair, I wanted to be able to pair this beverage with a meal. And to do that, I mean, I know I couldn't be a wine, but I knew I could bring really unique flavors. And if you want to have a really good, clean flavor, then you can't add too much sugar. Actually, your sweetness level is going to be very important as well as your acidity level. And so we couldn't add a lot of sugar. And in that, I created these in my kitchen. I didn't have access to all those crazy chemicals either, which is why Dry only has those four ingredients, which gives it that flavor and that taste. And so we're very different from the rest of the products out there and the different sodas out there because, A, we only have four ingredients. B, we only have a quarter to a third of that sugar of a regular soda. We're not putting anything artificial at all in these. It's about really getting to the essence of that flavor. So that's probably why we're pretty different.
Yeah. Well, now, what are the four ingredients?
So we start with, you know, the water. So it's all about the water. And then we use natural extracts and then the pure cane sugar. And then we use an acid. It helps with the flavor as well as with a preservative. So we use different forms of acid.
Now, when we first talked to you, you had about three flavors.
Yeah, well, we had four because we had our four original flavors. Yes, and now, yes, and now we're, I believe, at nine. Yes. So, and we're working on flavors all the time. I think that we understand that that's what our consumers are expecting from us is unique, you know, unique flavors and flavors well done. So we're always working on new stuff too. But yeah, we have nine in the 9 in the lineup right now.
First of all, I think that the message you send in your packaging expresses the quality of your product and also the sophistication of your product. And that prepares people for what they're going to get. And
thank you. I'm glad to hear that. That's what our hope is, for sure.
So now, what are some of these flavors? Let's talk about some of those.
Well, so we brought out Rainier Cherry. We brought that out a year or two ago. And the idea really behind Rainier Cherry was wanting to bring, you know, Rainier Cherries are from here in Washington, and we just thought it would be fun to do a flavor that was a little bit, people understood a little bit more, because we do have some of our herbal flavors like lavender, which was the original flavor, and juniper berry. And that's going to be a little bit different. And so we wanted to bring out Rainier Cherry, so that's a new one. And I love that one. It feels like such a treat in the middle of the day.
Huh?
We brought cucumber out several years ago, and that one's been very popular. And I'm really pleased with how that one came. Because, you know, all these flavors, we work really hard to get them just right. And so, in particular, I'm definitely very pleased with. And then for our 10-year anniversary, one of the fun things we did is we did our first reserve edition, where we did only 5,000 cases of a flavor. And this time we went back and we did lemongrass, because lemongrass was one of our original flavors. And it was always the chef's favorite. Whenever I would meet with chefs around the country, lemongrass was always their first favorite flavor, and so we thought it would be fun to bring that one back. So we have that one right now for just a limited more time. There's not many cases left. And for those listeners that aren't in the Northwest area, they can get them on Amazon. But so that's a fun flavor that we have as well.
Now, the funny thing you mentioned was just before we came on the air was something that Anne had pointed out in our initial interview, and that is that professional bartenders would be interested in your product. And you said, I never even thought about that.
Well, that's true. See, I'd like to try to pretend I was that smart to think through that. But what happened, actually, was really interesting is the very first chef I sat down with, before I even had the soda in the real bottles, I had them, these were just samples that I had, I took to a chef here in Seattle named Carrie Sear, and I sat down, and within literally 60 seconds of sitting down, the bartender just made a beeline right for us and wanted to know everything about it and started using it. And I realized that the restaurants were starting to use it. And then a few years later, when I was at a Tales of the Cocktail event, I realized how popular dry had really had become amongst mixologists, because we had a bit of a cult following there, and it was absolutely fascinating. So it's definitely a part of who we are now. And we actually have now done a celebration style bottle, which is 750 milliliters, and it's being sold in the mixer aisles of your the grocery stores, so people can really. And we, you know, the other thing we've been doing, too, is doing lots of work with different mixologists around the country to create recipes for dry. So if you go on our website, we have a whole cocktail creator that you can do. It's almost kind of like a little game that you can do and pick your spirit, pick your dry flavor, and then all these recipes will come. So
can you really explain that? I mean, is it simply that the mixologist is always looking for something a little bit different, or are they in love with people who don't drink? That seems very unlikely.
Well, no, actually, really what the reason for it is because of the fact, it's what I've been talking about, is A, that we're being very true to these flavors, and we're bringing creative flavors. So you didn't see very many lavender cocktails prior to lavender dry soda showing up, but now there's lavender cocktails everywhere. And it allows the mixologist to be able to use something that's much less sweet, so the flavors stay true, and be able to, you know, have this more sophisticated option, because really, if you think about it, there hasn't been any real innovation in the mixer aisles either. I mean, there's been all these great craft spirits. So if you buy a $50 bottle of tequila, you probably don't want to mix it with a 99-cent, you know, Schweppes Club soda or whatever.
Right.
You'd like to be able to have something, you know, a little more sophisticated. So exactly what we're trying to do, you know, with sparkling beverage and, you know, for just sipping and pairing, we'd like to do as well for the mixer. So, I think that's really where it came from.
It's going back to people that we know who are particularly fussy about that gin and tonic, although they don't know dry soda yet, will all kill and say, I want the Schweppes tonic water that's made in Europe. I don't want the rubbish that's made here, because because the one from over there just has sugar in it, and I know what that tastes like.
Right, exactly. Well, and, you know, actually, interestingly, tonic has a lot of calories in it. And so
yes,
one of the things
I
that's been
know,
nice about dry.
There's diet tonic, because a friend of ours drinks that.
Yeah, but it tastes disgusting.
Stuff, yeah.
It tastes disgusting.
Maybe you need to introduce him to the juniper berry. I think he'd be really happy with the juniper berry because it's only got the 15 grams of sugar in it for the whole 12-ounce bottle, but yet it's got, it tastes really good. So he can get, he doesn't have to have the diet.
this is a lady who has very fixed habits.
It will be difficult to change. I understand.
I think in that case, she's not interested in change, but clearly people are, and you succeeded in tuning into that. And, after 10 years now, it's time to look forward. And your spokesperson promised you would look forward and tell us what's in the future for dry soda. So why don't you take a crack at that one?
Well, I think we're looking, obviously there's still so much work to do here in the U.S. of just introducing more and more people to dry. I think one of the exciting things that we're looking forward to is doing more of these reserve additions where we just, make 5,000 to 10,000 cases and we can really experiment with different flavors, because that's what we're all here at Dry Soda so passionate about, are these flavors. And then there's, I'm always looking out into the world and where else might we want to go. And the UK is an area that we're super interested in and have been spending some time. I've been spending a lot of time in London over the last few years and feel like there's some good opportunity for international expansion as well. So that's, I think, mostly what we have on our horizon at the moment.
Here's a killer flavor for you. And I was reminded of this.
What?
Because somebody sends us a photograph of fish and chips in Yorkshire, which is my home part of the country, and right next to it wasn't beer, it was a large bottle of a soda which is very, very popular in the north of England called Dandelion and Burdock.
Fentimans does that one. That one's actually so good.
Yeah, if you want to conquer the UK market, I suggest a dry soda, Dandelion and Burdock, would fit right in there.
Well, I will definitely look into that. Well, I do like the Fentimans one, yes.
I mean,
this is something that's also on trend, is anything bitter, as you figured out, I'm sure. I mean, did you?
Well, yeah. That I'm super excited about because my cocktail of choice is a Negroni. So I love
Campari.
Oh, that's
Peter. He loves it too.
But yes, and I definitely love the bitter. So I'm super excited to see that that's continuing to be a trend so we can.
Yeah, did you read that book? What's her name?
Give us a clue. It's called The Bible.
It's called The Book. Bitter. It's McLaughlin.
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
I'll get it. It'll give you inspiration.
Yeah, she wrote a book. Another
She's
one called
fabulous.
Yeah, she wrote a book called Bones, and she wrote another one called
Fat.
Fat.
And this one is Bitter.
Oh gosh, I'm gonna look that up. I didn't even know about that.
She's Australian, right?
Okay.
Isn't she Australian? I think so.
Is she?
And the book is just called Bitter.
Bitter.
Yeah.
That's it.
But anyway, Dandelion and Burdock is the thing. There's another flavor called Bitter Lemon, which I always thought was kind of artificial.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never tasted a good bitter lemon myself.
There you go.
But that's actually a good idea. Well, I'm writing that down.
Well, good. Well, you're writing it.
I referred to it when I did my article on the Fancy Food Show for this year, is at the beverage revolution, because that's exactly where we are. I mean, we went through four different flavors of sipping vinegars, which I absolutely adored.
I love those.
Yeah.
Those are so great. Yep.
And what was my favorite one of those? I'm trying to remember.
I think you like the Chinese cabbage.
Oh, the Chinese celery.
Chinese celery.
Chinese celery. There's a flavor for you.
Huh. I'm writing that one down, too.
Yeah. So, these sipping vinegars, it's one thing. And then the other thing that was making a splash, but I wrote about it last year, was the owl, where they have something that you mix with a lot of other components that dilute, the flavors. And maybe you can collaborate with some of these vinegar companies, too, and do recipes with that.
Yeah, I actually have. There is a vinegar company that came to me a couple years ago, and I'm going to forget the name of it right now. And we made some cocktails with the vinegar and the dry, and they were amazing.
Was this eight something? Eight?
No, it was I can't remember the name. It was an Asian name, and I'm not going to remember it right now.
This is, I think, New England.
Hmm? I think it's Ginkgo Shen or something like that.
But. Oh, well, this one is something eight, below eight, isn't it? Below eight?
Yeah, it's the guy from Canada.
Oh, he's Canadian.
He's from Niagara on the Lake.
Oh, it's fabulous, fabulous vinegars. And they're you know, we went to, he did a dinner where he paired the vinegars with food.
Oh, how fun. Yeah. Oh, that would be great.
So I guess that's something else you can do is you can do pairings around the country.
We're so smart. We should tell
we've got dinners. Lots of chefs do that. They'll pair dry soda throughout tasting menus, and French Laundry does that. And
do they really?
I had a wonderful meal at French Laundry with them doing that. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Well, you'll have to come back and see us much sooner than the 7 years it took you the first time.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I'll make sure we stay in touch.
Well, thank you so much.
I guess that you're with your family pretty well grown. You have more time to play around and develop everything, huh?
Yes, and I've been spending a lot of time traveling the world these days, too, getting inspiration. So I was
just in Turkey,
and there was lots of fun inspirations there as well. So,
well, good talking to you as usual, Sherelle.
Thank you so much, guys.
Keep
it's
up
so
the
good to
success.
Talk to you.
Yeah, keep up the good success.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, it's time to take a break, but don't go away because we'll be right back with another fascinating story about what you can do and what you can't do with grapes.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And here's a new answer to that age-old question, what do you want to be when you grow up? The answer for Jack Pandol and his partner Jim Beagle, grape breeders. How about that? And not only that, but table grape breeders.
And not only that, but table grape breeders who produce table grapes that taste absolutely fabulous. It's interesting. We're talking grapes. We're talking grapes of the variety that Mae West once said, peel me a grape. I think she said that to W.C. Fields in a movie.
Yeah.
Peel me a grape. Huh?
And my mother, my dear departed mother, actually peeled grapes her whole life.
Yeah, and she never had a grape in my house because I wasn't peeling any.
I've heard that, and it's fairly common in the Asian markets we ship grapes to for them to peel grapes.
Yeah, but you're not just shipping grapes now. What's this guy's name? Jim Beagle.
Yeah.
He's not in the Peanuts cartoon strip, regardless of what you think, but he has a very different take on table grapes, and the story of how he got there I think is a great place to start. Jim, fill us in.
Sure. I grew up in the table grape business. My father works for a large farming company here in the San Joaquin Valley in Bakersfield. So I grew up here as a young child, harvesting grapes on the weekends and during summers and doing all the odd jobs in the vineyards. So it's been in my family for generations, and it's in my blood. My partner, Jack Pandol, founded Grapery, the company I'm a partner in now, in 1996. His family goes back many generations also in the table grape business locally. So we've both been at it literally our entire lives. And it's in our blood, it's our passion, and it's what we love to do.
I mean, it must be a big schism. We interview vintners all the time from California and other places too, but a lot in California. And, you know, I don't think I've ever interviewed another table grape producer from California. There must be a huge schism between the vintners and the table grape people.
It's interesting. We don't relate to each other as closely as one might think, though there are a lot of similarities. There are some differences. Prior to joining Grapery, I spent some time growing wine grapes in the north coast of California, in Napa and Sonoma, and I would feel fortunate to have done so. The challenges are different to grow grapes only for flavor and with no concern for appearance as a wine grape grower, and to grow them in cool climates, usually with much more variable soils, with much more limited water supplies than we have in the San Joaquin Valley. So there's very different challenges, but one of the things that's transferred well for me as one of the few people that's crossed over and done both high-quality wine grapes and high-quality table grapes is the lessons I learned in wine grapes about how you grow for great flavor. And that's the thing that differentiates our company, Grapery, now, and that we're continuing to innovate with, and how do you grow table grapes for great flavor.
Now, Jack, your partner, Jack Pandel, has this idea about actual breeding back to the original flavors of heritage grapes. Did he have extra scientific training, like plant genetics or something?
Jack really had the vision that there was something missing in the table grape world, along with his partners, Sunridge Nurseries, when they formed a breeding program. And they hired a geneticist. He has a PhD in plant genetics, and his name is Dr. David Kane. And in the grape world, he's famous as a really skilled and talented grape breeder. And together, they all felt like there was a vision and a future for bringing great flavor back into grapes. The challenge, really, in the last 20 years, our whole food industry and fresh produce supply chain has been so built around cost and efficiency and scale that there's tremendous pressure in the supply chain. So growers, breeders, marketers, retailers, there's tremendous pressure to deliver beautiful looking produce at very cheap prices.
The chips will.
Correct. And that have a very long shelf life.
Right.
And it doesn't have to taste good, because by the time it's gone off to the supermarket shelf, you got it anyway. You can't really take it back.
That's right. And what we as farmers all, you know, typically, and there's exceptions, what we typically hear from the market is the things that are important are shelf life and cheap. And farmers, we're no different from farmers anywhere in the world in the history of mankind. We're very innovative. And we've figured out how to deliver very cheap produce that has a very long shelf life. The problem is that has the things that give you those characteristics tend to be counter to great flavor. And over time, there's been this trend away from flavor. And I don't think any farmer or breeder or grocer would ever tell you that flavor isn't important. It's just become less of a priority, and so we've ended up with produce with less flavor over time. And I don't think that's just true for grapes. I think it's true
for
tomatoes.
Everything.
And
what about the seedless stuff? Is that part of this problem, too, doing seedless things?
Seedless, I think, is something that started earlier than that really is more consumer-focused. People like to eat seedless grapes, and that's we're seeing as really a worldwide phenomenon, really cross-cultural. We ship to a lot of markets around the world, and consumers tend to prefer things without big seeds in them. And seeds tend to have the bitter compounds and the tannins and some of the things that are a little bit off-putting anyway. So it tends to be a better eating experience for being seedless. But there was a real innovation that happened about 20 years ago around how to breed seedless grape varieties. And that's why there's an explosion of new table grape varieties being developed. What we saw, though, was there's a push towards developing seedless varieties that have all these characteristics we just discussed and away from flavor. So what our breeder did was he went back originally to the old varieties, the Rebeers and the Tokays and the Emperors, and varieties that most people probably don't remember that had seeds that were grown predominantly in California that had great flavor. And our breeder went back and used those older varieties as parent material to make crosses with seedless grapes to bring those flavors back into seedless grapes. That was the start of the breeding program in 2000. And it takes at least, on average, 10 to 12 years and sometimes longer.
Yeah, I was just, you read my mind. That was my next question, because we talked to an apple breeder that said it took 20 years to develop that sweet tango apple.
And things like cherries, I know, also take that long. And grapes,
right.
I guess maybe we're fortunate it only takes 10 to 12 years.
It's still a long time.
It's still a long time, yes.
Let's keep our listeners on track here, because I want to make sure that we don't lose them before we get to Moon Glow. Moon drops.
Moon drops.
And what's the other one?
Cotton candy.
Cotton candy grapes.
Are they varieties that already existed?
No, they're not. They didn't. That was the next thing I was going to turn the discussion to.
Tell us about that, because I was trying, I didn't know whether you were breeding back to original native varieties or you were trying for those flavors but adding something original.
So once we had this focus on flavor and had targeted some of the older traditional table grape varieties, then our breeder went and looked beyond that to some things that are native to the grape world but never produced commercially for fresh grapes. So a lot of your listeners might be familiar with things like Concord grapes, scuppernongs, muscadines. Concords are commonly known as the grape that's used to make Welch's grape juice or a lot of the grape jellies and jams and processed things. But those grapes have big seeds, thick skins, often bitter skins. They get very mushy right after you harvest them, so they have no shelf life to ship commercially.
Oh, yeah.
And in the 1960s, the University of Arkansas started a breeding program to cross those, all of those species of grapes, which are native to the eastern United States, with the Mediterranean species of grapes that we grow that are the traditional table grapes, as well as the Cabernet, Chardonnay, Merlot. Those are all varieties of Mediterranean species of grapes. The species that are native to the eastern U.S. have the disease resistance to grow in those humid climates, so they were trying to cross those with the Mediterranean species to come up with seedless and thin-skinned grapes that had the disease resistance to develop an industry in the southeastern United States, and it didn't really ever pan out, so our breeder got exclusive worldwide license on that plant material and brought it out to California and is building on 50 years of generations of crosses and back crosses of, of interspecies grape varieties, which are much more tricky to cross. And he's getting the flavors of those native, wonderful species that are natural to the grape world into thin-skinned and seedless grapes. And that's where we come up with some really interesting both shapes and flavors.
The shapes are
really cool. I mean, one of them... Only one of them can I describe, and that's moondrops I can describe as being cylinders. So they have an equal diameter all the way from top to bottom, or bottom to top, which I've never seen before. I mean, it's like unbelievable, and I don't know where does the stalk actually attach? I don't even know.
Oh, it does at one end. I mean,
is it one end?
Look
okay.
At the bunch of it. And then witch's fingers are even longer.
Are they? Okay.
Yeah.
Watch out for witch's fingers. They didn't come yet, did they?
But is that something original that you developed, or did we always have grapes that were shaped like that?
There were always grapes that are shaped like that that are native to the southeastern U.S. A lot of them tended to have seeds or other problems.
Mm-hmm.
So these are cross breeds with Mediterranean species that take the best characteristics from each.
So, like, take this cotton candy grape that actually tastes like you injected a flavor into it.
It's incredible how much the flavor tastes like cotton candy. And it's important to know, and it's very interesting, it's unique for this piece of fruit. Most fruit tastes better at room temperature. More of the aromatics release at higher temperatures, and you get a more full sensation of flavors. Cotton candy grapes are the opposite. The cotton candy flavor is much more intense when the fruit is refrigerated. Many people even freeze the grapes and eat them frozen, and the flavor is even more intense.
I did. I mean, I tested it.
I think they do that with scuppernongs, too.
I think they freeze those, too.
I think they do. We came across them because our son and daughter-in-law live in South Carolina.
I never even heard of them before.
Somehow or other, we came across scuppernongs.
They were in the Whole Foods market.
Is that where they were? Okay, in the Whole Foods in Greenville.
Interesting.
So absolutely remarkable things, but it's plant science that was abandoned by somebody because they really weren't getting where they wanted, and your partner picked up that.
You know what's interesting? Actually, the cotton candy lineage goes back even further. In the 1870s, the French wine industry was almost wiped out by a root pest called phylloxera.
Yeah, got it.
That's right. Phylloxera is a root pest, a soil pest that's native to the United States. and all these native species in the United States are resistant to phylloxera. So somehow some soil got transported to Europe and a phylloxera infestation got a hold of the wine regions in France, and it almost completely wiped out the industry.
Yeah, right.
Some of the initial efforts to resolve that problem were some crossbreeding that happened in the 1870s to cross the Cabernet, Chardonnay, Merlot varieties they were growing there with the species that were native here to the eastern U.S. to try to get some of those phylloxera-resistant traits. And that's breeding that is still goes on today in developing rootstocks for wine grapes around the world. And we can actually trace the lineage of the cotton candy grapes all the way back to those crosses that happened in the 1870s.
Now, the interesting thing is you're talking here now about breeding grapes, but I understand that the trick in the wine grape business is you don't actually produce a new variety, but you do produce a graft. So you graft the grape you want onto a stem which is disease resistant, but has really absolutely nothing to do with producing fruit other than delivering nutrition to the grapes.
That's exactly right.
Now you're saying that in the table grape business it's a little bit different?
It's the same thing in the table grape business. We can have different pests and different pest pressures, and we have different climates where pests respond differently. Wine grapes need warm days and very cool nights. Table grapes need hot days and very warm nights for high quality in both. So we have a few differences, but generally, yes, you develop rootstocks that either provide disease resistance or vigor control, so you have a sense of how large or strong or weak your plant might be, and match that to the fertility of your soil. So there's a whole science that goes into rootstocks, and then you graft any variety you want to grow on top of that, and that grows the fruit that you want.
It's the same thing.
I keep trying to get my head around where you start. You start with something that a flavor you want to resurrect, or with these other characteristics, or what? I mean, do you taste something and then say, wouldn't it be great to have a grape that tasted like that? I mean, I don't understand.
No, a lot of people ask that question, and we're really not smart enough to be that targeted. I think we just feel like we take all these wonderful varieties that have these fantastic flavors, and it's like throwing a lot of spices into a pot and mixing them up and seeing what you come out with. We know we're going to come out with something that tastes great. We just don't really know what it's going to taste like or what it's going to look like.
You don't even have a clue.
No, we don't.
Oh, well, fun. That must be wonderful.
That's interesting.
But we do have a clue that, I mean, there are a lot of wonderful natural grape flavors in the world that tend to run along the lines of fruity flavors. You can get tropical flavors in grapes. You can get plum-like, cherry-type flavors, currants. You can get pineapples and mangoes and strawberries and raspberries and all kinds of hints of flavors out of grapes. If you listen to anybody who's really into wine describe wines, you hear all those characteristics, and those are all native natural flavors to the grape world. And somehow we got cotton candy. That was just luck. But we knew, and we know we're still developing many varieties that are going to taste wonderful. Cotton candy was just the first variety to come out of the breeding program that has this unique genetic background. But there's many, many more in the pipeline. It takes 12 years to develop these.
Well, how many do you have developed now? And when we've talked before, they come available at different times because of the seasons, right?
Yes. So, yeah, we have 28 different varieties that we're testing and growing right now. And some of them won't ever be viable for one reason or another. We sometimes taste something that we think would be great, and when we put it in front of consumers, it falls flat. Some things have wonderful flavor, but there's so many farming challenges to produce a viable economic crop that we can't produce it commercially. There's all kinds of reasons to eliminate varieties from our test program, but it's very thorough. We test a lot of things. Most things fail, but every once in a while, one of them sticks.
I mean, how many do you actually sell?
We'll sell probably 12 different grape varieties commercially this year.
And are they all on your website?
Not all of them. We've been around as a company for a long time, so we still produce some of the traditional commercial varieties that uh-huh. most people grow. But what's interesting, it's funny, there's a lot of confusion in the table grape world right now because there's this explosion of new varieties, and many of them aren't very different from each other. And when we started to release these new varieties, we would go to retailers and consumers and offer them this variety or that variety, and it gets so confused, it would just create more problems than it would solve.
Mm-hmm.
We really, with some consumer testing we did that I can talk more about if you want, we came to the realization that what consumers really care about is flavor. They care about flavor far more than anything else. Price is important, but flavor is the most important thing to most consumers.
But, I mean, do they want a flavor, like just something that tastes like a grape, or do they have some other thing like a grape that tastes like a plum?
Well, what's interesting is everybody's different. There's people who think cotton candy grapes are the best grapes they've ever had, or there's people who think that grapes that taste like grapes, but really like they should really taste, are the best thing in grapes. And so we developed this label called Flavor Promise. If you look on our website and you look at the different things we offer,
give us
the
website, by the way, before we forget. The company is called The Grapery. There's no "the" in the actual website, is there?
Correct. Our company name is Grapery, and the website is www.grapery.biz, B-I-Z.
B-I-Z. I knew there was something different. Okay. So go back to what you're saying.
So one of the things you'll see we offer on our website is a Flavor Promise label. And our Flavor Promise label is grapes that taste like grapes, but they taste like grapes should really taste. And it's a very high standard for flavor, and we're very disciplined about what goes into that label. Not all of our grapes make that standard every year. It's farming, and we're subject to weather and disease and pests and other issues, and so not everything qualifies for that. But when you, as a consumer, see Flavor Promise, it might be a red grape, a green grape, or a black grape. It might be early in the California season or late and be different varieties, but it will meet a flavor standard that will wow you, as grapes that taste like grapes really should taste. After that, we have, beyond Flavor Promise, we have our variations that are beyond what grapes should taste like. So things like cotton candy that are unexpected, or unique shapes like our witch fingers and our moon drops, which is our newest variety with a fantastic flavor and a really exciting
I love those moon drops.
That's great.
Yeah.
We have other things in trials that are coming out. We have a grape that we're going to introduce to the market next year that we've had some tests of and that we planted last season. It takes 2 years to come into production. So we have a new variety that we're calling Gumdrops that will be in its first commercial volume in the 2016 grape season. And it's got a wonderful fruit-like flavor that's very similar to a Welch's grape juice kind of a flavor in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
We have other things that we test that never go very far. We have some muscat-flavored grapes that we're testing, and we haven't quite found the right variety from a commercial standpoint, but it's interesting, the muscat flavor, though it's a favorite of Jack and I, and the breeder, we were so excited when we found that flavor. It tends to be very polarizing with the general public, consumers. People either love that flavor or they hate it, and we have to be careful about not.
Well, you know, this is also true of the cotton candy grapes. Some people love it and some people hate it.
That's true.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
But the general public, and this is from the produce buyer at my Whole Foods just down the street where I got your shipment. He said, we can't keep them on the shelf. They fly off the shelf. He said, I got 10 cases today and they'll be gone. and I don't know when I'm going to get any more. He said, it's really terrible. But I guess it's a good thing to happen, and it's a sign that, Jack and yourself have really invented something special, and in the agricultural environment in California, that's pretty clever.
Thank you.
Those Californians, they found most things, but you found your own niche. Well done.
Thank you. We're excited to see the success that cotton candy has, and it's great to hear those stories and how happy people are when they taste the grapes. we struggle a little bit because it's such a slow process to bring more into production, and we're so focused on quality. If we grow our volume too quickly, we won't be able to continue to deliver on the quality. There's so many variables in the field, and cotton candy is one of the more difficult grapes that we've ever produced. It's very tough to farm. So we're very conscious of making sure that we maybe don't grow as fast as a lot of people think we should to make it more available, but to make sure that we always deliver on that promise that it's going to taste like cotton candy. And so I think it's going to be exciting to see some of these newer varieties come out that we have an ability to produce more consistently. I think we're going to be able to meet a lot more people's needs when they go to a Whole Foods or go to any of our, we have some really fantastic retail partners around the country that we work with that people can find the grapes on a more consistent basis, because I know they're very tough to find right now, and we, you know, a lot of people really want to try these grapes, and they're really hard to find. It's a really short season, and I wish supplies were larger, but it is a nice problem to have, and we hear it over and over again about they get 10 cases in the store and they sell out right away. But we would like people to be able to find them when they're looking for them. Well, and to that end, on our website, we do have a retail locator tab. So if anybody goes on our website and clicks on that, a map of the United States will pop up, and you can also switch to a map of Canada, and you can click on any state in the union, and up will pop a list of retailers with whom we work when we have supplies available.
Well, you're surprising, and you're excited with what you're doing, and I'm delighted to have found you. So thanks for talking to us, Jim, and I'm going to periodically check that website to see what you're coming up with next.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on the show.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, it seems that Cara Nicoletti and I read pretty much the same books growing up and currently, but I wasn't as focused on food as she was, it seems. You should listen and see this book, where you may not remember it, but these classics hold luscious meals throughout.
And the name of the book is Voracious, which gives you kind of an idea.
Exactly.
this lady,
temperament we're dealing with here.
this lady really likes her Tucker and really likes
likes books.
She likes her literature too.
Cara Nicoletti has many, many interesting, I don't want to say quirks to your background, but you're a very interesting composite of many different avenues. The book you've just written is called Voracious. A hungry reader cooks her way through great books. Your graduate work started out in literature. Family, you come from a family
of a
butchers.
Yes, she's a butcher. There
and you're a butcher and a pastry chef.
Fits right in.
Yes.
And a barista. And did you know, by the way, that Gabriel Hamilton has a master's in literature from the University of Michigan?
Yeah. And I loved her book, Blood, Bones, and Butter, because she wrote about kind of pull between choosing her life as a reader and as a cook, and I felt that a lot when I was in school.
Yeah, well, I was thinking you probably knew about that.
Yeah, it's a great book. I think it's one of my favorite food memoirs.
She seems like a lot like she might be a butcher too. I'm not sure she is.
Yeah, well, it's funny because everybody went to the University of Michigan. Ruth Reichel and I both got masters in art history from the University of Michigan.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I thought what was interesting about your book, I'm going to let you explain exactly what the subject is or how to explain the subject of the book. But I wanted to say that especially with the early childhood reading and the adolescent reading, you and I pretty much read the same books.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
But I did not have these moments of the dining scene or the food scenes stand out, and I never could. I'm reading your book, and I don't know why I don't remember any of those things you're talking about.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I think that I think some people are drawn to those scenes and some people aren't, but I'm always surprised by how many people do remember the food scenes in the books they read as kids, because there really are so many.
Yeah, well, you're going to tell us exactly what the subject of this book is. What were you
doing? So this book is about book of essays, but it's also a cookbook, and it's recipes and essays based on food scenes and literature. So the book follows kind of my development also as a reader and as a cook. So it's split into three sections: books that I read when I was a child, and into books I read as an adolescent, and then books I read during my college years and my adulthood. And it also talks about restaurants I was working in during those times, foods I was eating, food memories. So it's all kind of, it's nostalgia and recipes, you know, that are based on literature.
And see, I mean, the Aeneid, I read it in Latin, actually.
I did too. Yeah, it was, because I was an English major, but I was a Latin, I was a double major. And so when I was reading it, I was translating it in college.
Well, I thought maybe that's why I didn't remember the honey poppy seed cake.
Yeah. No, it's in there. It's in there even in the Latin.
Well, now, can you honestly say that as a child you were reading, like, my favorite book in third grade was The Secret Garden.
Oh, yeah, that's a wonderful book.
Yeah, but was not that impressed as you were with all these, the food scenes, you know, except of course they were growing vegetables and flowers. But now, can you honestly say that that was something that you had happening to you, getting impressed by the food scenes when you were that age, reading these books, or is it something you realized when you decided to write this book and you went back and thought about the earlier experience?
No, I mean, this is something that's been sort of an obsession of mine since I was a really little kid, and I kind of lost it along the way in college and in high school, but when I was writing the book and doing research for the book, my parents sent me a huge shipment of my books from childhood, and a lot of them had underlines and, like, little notes about the food scenes, and I don't know, I think it was a way for me to make the characters that I really loved feel more earthly, more real. So it was something that I was focused on when I was a kid, and then it sort of disappeared from me and reappeared, like, late in college and then after college.
I see. Yeah, I mean, because I looked at your notes. I mean, I love reading your notes about the books. But when I was reading Goodbye to All That, as an adult, mind you, it never occurred to me about the grilled peaches and homemade ricotta.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a tragic book in many ways. It was sad.
It's a beautiful book of essays, and that essay in particular, I think a lot of people, especially people who have lived or live in New York, it's kind of an iconic essay. But I think at that point, when I was reading that, I mean, I was out of college, and I was already focused on food scenes and literature. So I do think that as I got older, I started reading. When I was young, it happened organically because a lot of children's books have food in them, and they figure very heavily into the narrative. But once I was writing the blog and kind of focused on food scenes and literature, it changed the way that I read. So if I had read Goodbye to All That when I was in high school, it's possible I wouldn't have even noticed the peach that she ate. But I was at a point in my life where it was something that I was focused on.
Right. So anyhow, so essentially what you do is you take these books that you have loved, and you do an essay preceding the recipes, describing the food scene and your interest and involvement with the literature based on this, and then you follow it with a recipe.
So yes.
Let's start. Pick one of these that you'd like to just talk about. Should we do Hansel and Gretel?
Sure.
Okay. Because, you know, I think I actually read the original one, so I wasn't as shocked as you said you were. I still have the original one. I have Grimm's and Anderson. Both
oh, I bet those are beautiful.
Yeah,
they're a little bit scary.
Yeah, they are. Scary. They're grim.
you wouldn't want to be a bad boy or a bad girl, otherwise you'd really be in trouble.
Now, which was the one about the geese that that poor woman, the sister knitting the sweaters that she had to throw over her brothers with the curse, and she couldn't finish one of them, and he got stuck with a wing.
I remember one about like a magic pot of porridge. I don't know; they were all very scary, but Hansel and Gretel have really gotten a makeover over the years, haven't they?
Well, yes, I mean,
and that was before Disney got a hold of it.
Yes,
yep, exactly.
So you have two experiences with this book. One is you read the cleaned up version, mm-hmm. and then you were shocked when you got the original.
Mm-hmm.
But through all that, you really wanted to build these gingerbread houses with your two girlfriends.
Yes. And that is something that we did. We read the book together and we made a gingerbread house together.
Gingerhead browsers, there you go. Everybody knows that.
Yeah, but the thing is, as an adult, gingerbread houses actually drive me insane because you spend all this time baking things and everything smells good and looks delicious and you don't eat it, like for decoration. So I didn't do a gingerbread house for the recipe. I did like a really dense, dark, beautiful gingerbread cake that you can eat.
Now, you seem to have a sort of a two-sided view of Maurice Sendak and where the wild,
wild
things are.
I adore Maurice Sendak.
Oh, well, I love this In the Night Kitchen, the essay you wrote, and your take on the whole thing.
Our son grew up on Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah, he's another one besides Roald Dahl that really, his books really stand up as an adult, find things when you're reading them.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Oh, there's a serious dark side to Maurice.
Yes, absolutely.
There's no question about that.
Yeah, well, another one who does that is the guy with Shrek. I mean, reading those books to Adam as a child never prepared me for half the stuff when I saw the movies made out of them.
Oh, you know, I those were not books that I read as a kid, but I read them to the kids that I babysat for. And I actually had no idea that Shrek was based on books until like a couple years ago. But they are wildly different than the movies.
Right.
Well, I'm seriously worried because we used to take books to our children. Whenever we visited, there always had to be new books. Now the only thing there is Angry Birds.
Oh, no, you have to keep reading the books.
No, that's not true. They always say, Nana, Granddad, where are the books?
Yeah, but they
have to keep bringing the books.
Oh, we do.
Someday they'll be grateful for it.
Yeah, I just wish I could skip this whole princess stage. That was not, I feel about this princess business the way you feel about Nancy Drew.
Yeah.
but
well, at least Nancy Drew could shoot a gun. It's kind of cool. The princesses are, I don't know, I guess they're trying to sort of make them a little bit more independent. And Frozen, a lot of people were interested in Frozen and the portrayal of girls in that. But I'd still take Nancy Drew over that any day, even though I didn't like it very much.
So, and I never read The Witches. So what is that about?
It's about a little boy who lives with his grandmother, Norwegian woman. She's a fantastic character. She smokes cigars. And she teaches him about the existence of witches, which in the book, it's a very realistic thing. Witches exist in the world, and they sort of sneak around unseen. And he gets captured by the witches and turned into a mouse.
Really?
And it's just this really scary, it absolutely terrified me as a kid. And even rereading it as a grown-up, I thought, I can't believe I was allowed to read this. But it's interesting to read it as an adult because, of course, Roald Dahl wasn't the biggest fan of women. And it's interesting to read it from that point of view as a grown-up and see sort of what he's saying about signs that you can look for in a woman to, you know, prove that she's a witch and she's sort of deranged. It's a really interesting book, and it's beautifully written, and the grandmother is a fantastic character.
Well, where does the recipe come from?
So, in the book, the grandmother is talking about her childhood in Norway. She
she grew up on the water, and she used to watch the fishing boats come in, and they would sort of wait for the fishing boats to come in, and they would get bushels of shrimp that had just been steamed on the boat and eat them, and they would cook cod over the fire, so, and mussels. So I made a stew with all of those things, and it's actually one of my favorite recipes in the book. It's really delicious.
Oh, well, it sounds like it's the kind of thing I love anyhow.
Yeah.
Who would have supposed that you would select of all these things to include with the recipe, The Silence of the Lambs? Isn't that a stretch?
Why not? You have to cut things up somehow.
Yeah, I would say that The Silence of the Lambs and Lord of the Flies were the two recipes that when I submitted an essay that when I submitted, I thought, Little Brown's never going to let me do this. But they did, and I was really lucky that they did, because food scenes in books are often really crucial to the story. And in both cases, the pig's head is really crucial to Lord of the Flies. It is the Lord of the Flies.
Right.
And the chicken liver and fava bean, or I guess it's human liver and fava bean scene.
Yeah, right.
Silence of the Lambs is also iconic. So these are two very memorable things in literature, and might not be necessarily the most delicious, but they definitely provoke a reaction, and you definitely remember them. So
you selected for The Catcher in the Rye malted milk ice cream.
Yes.
Do you want to elaborate on that?
Sure. Well, Holden Caulfield is not a big eater. He's a very skinny teenage boy. He has a weird appetite, and one of the things that he loves to eat is cheese sandwiches and malted milk. That's like his favorite meal, and I chose to make it into an ice cream because it's kind of impossible to give a recipe for malted milk. It's basically just malt powder and milk, and it's interesting too because Founder had a lot of really strange food issues and anxieties, and I thought malt...
He was weird.
Yeah, he was a weird guy, and a lot of his eccentricities were around food, and malt was originally thought of as kind of like a health food, something that would aid in your digestion. So I thought it was an interesting thing to focus on because Salinger himself was pretty focused on that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Now, so you probably also have an opinion on the prequel of To Kill a Mockingbird. What happened to Scout's dad?
I just picked it up, and I'm feeling so guilty about picking it up because I know that Harper Lee did not want anyone to read it.
That's exactly what I think too, by the way.
I can't help myself. I haven't cracked it open yet. It's sort of sitting on my bedside table haunting me.
I have no, I've seen people reading it like on the pool and things like that. And I made a vow I would never, ever pick it up. I mean, she's
so
manipulated.
Well, you're a better person than I am. I couldn't help myself. My curiosity got the better of me, and I did pick it up, but I haven't opened it yet, so it's yet to be seen if I'll actually read it. So I figure at least, you know, maybe she made some money off of me, whether I read it or not.
Right.
The interesting thing is we interviewed the lady who wrote Wind Done Gone.
Oh, right.
Oh, okay.
she was we interviewed her together with her daughter. From different places.
Why? I can't remember why we did that.
Some aspects of African-American food, but I don't remember exactly what it was.
Oh. Okay.
But it turned out rather surprisingly that this lady had a professional writing career, and she said, by the way, I wrote this book called Wind Done Gone.
I've never read that
which everyone's forgotten about, but I think the reception, that it got was really good.
Oh, cool.
And it was a different viewpoint, but the sequel to Gone with the Wind did very poorly, if you'll recall.
Yeah, it did. I've never even seen it in bookstores.
But the crossover, which was done much earlier, apparently was quite an interesting piece of work.
Huh. I'll have to look into that, because there is a lot of food in Gone with the Wind, so
there'll
be a lot of food in that one, too.
I'm sure there is.
Well, yeah. I mean, you've found a niche here. I mean, I've seen endless presentations of food scenes from movies, but this is the first time that I saw that applied to something that's actually an action in the mind as opposed to on the screen.
Yeah, like a visual thing. It's interesting because when I started the blog years ago, there really were no other, I remember sort of Googling before I started it, if there were other blogs doing that, just because I didn't want to be unoriginal, and there was nothing. And now they're popping up every day, which I think is wonderful because it means that I'm not the only person who's kind of fixated on this.
Oh, do mention your blog, please.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the blog is called Yummy Book, and I started it after I graduated from college. Started in 2009. I graduated in 2008. And originally it was a book club, and then it was a supper club, and then I turned it into a blog, and then the blog turned into a book. But the blog is still around, and I hope it will be around for a long time.
Okay, and on the blog, do you pursue the same line of,
yes,
of literary references to food, or food and literary references?
Yeah, it's really pretty much, the book is just a continuation of the blog, sort of in a more organized form. Or the blog tends to lately be more focused on modern writers, people who are currently writing, because it's nice to be able to connect with them and say, I wrote about your book. And also, it gets a lot of hits from people who are in book clubs and looking for things to make for their book club meetings. So,
oh, yeah, that's a...
But it is. It's basically the same thing as book.
That's a natural for your book club or something.
As a way of concluding, you have what is probably Victorian literature's longest cliffhanger, which is who was the benefactor to Pip Gargery?
I'm not going to say, because if I say, then it will ruin it for someone who's never read Great Expectations.
I got 3/4 of the way through the book, and I fell for it too. I thought it was the other person.
Nothing was further
from my mind than Magwitch the
I know
convict.
It's the most shocking, one of the most shocking reveals.
That's what I mean by a cliffhanger, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, Kara, I wish you a lot of success with this book, and I think
you
get two great audiences for one book here, literary and culinary.
Yes. So thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
You too, Kara. Ciao.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And there you have it. Another show, another Sunday. Join us again, same time, same place next week on another Sunday. And until then,
bye-bye.